This is Financial Standard, the definitive source of news, thought leadership and analysis for Australian wealth management professionals. Financial Standard, take the lead.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Financial Standard podcast. My name is Eliza Bavin, and I'm a senior journalist here at Financial Standard. With the recent market mayhem global investors have endured, it can be beneficial to take a look back in time and take stock of the lessons that we've learned from the past and how they can be applied today to navigate what may be a very bumpy road ahead. So to take us through it, I'm pleased to welcome Head of Investment Strategy at Challenger, Pete Robinson. Welcome, Pete.
Thanks for having me.
So to say that it's been a tumultuous ride this year would be a bit of an understatement. We saw markets rally when Trump was elected president. We then saw that quickly reverse when he announced his Liberation Day tariffs. And of course, we've then seen them go up and down as he has gone hard, heavy on the tariffs and then taken them off again and then gone hard on China and then reversed on that. So it has been absolutely a very bumpy road. And I know that you've said that some simple questions could have helped avoid a lot of the fallout from the GFC. So I'm wondering how the same can maybe be applied here to the volatility that we're now seeing today. Are there simple questions that investors should be asking themselves?
It's interesting because I think if we look back to the GFC and we look at the volatility we've just experienced, you know, really this is kind of a drop in the ocean. So we have short memories in markets and it feels at the time pretty uncertain. And I think things like the US getting downgraded, that feels like a big event. But when we have that broader and longer term perspective, I think we can kind of manage the bumps along the road a lot better. And so I guess one big thing I think coming out of the GFC, you know, that highlighted a particular risk that I've taken with me throughout my career is this idea of always questioning the narrative. And so what you tend to find is that the greatest instabilities that emerge within markets emerge from beliefs that are perhaps firmly held and widely held across the market by a large group of participants, and they base really significant investment allocations and investment decisions off the back of that. And so if we look at the global financial crisis, you know, one of the things that I always used to hear was that the US has never had a year-on-year decline in house prices, and that the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were implicitly supported by the government. Now, of course, both of those narratives were beliefs rather than facts, like that would be held throughout time. You could argue that the year-on-year decline was a fact, but the reality was just because it hadn't happened in the 30 years for which we had data, didn't mean it was never going to happen into the future. And certainly this idea of implicit support, there was nothing documented that said that if some of these mortgage-backed securities ran into stress, that they were going to get bailed out by the federal government. I think that's an important thing to look back on today is, like, you know, looking at the state of the US fiscal deficit. And I think certainly the position of the US dollar within the global kind of monetary system, you know, I'm not suggesting kind of extreme actions as a result of this. I think it's important that investors question that narrative about the primacy of US dollars and some of the actions that they take. So we've got large amounts of superannuation funds being invested offshore. You know, someone like Aussie Super says they're investing 70% of their assets offshore. They're not hedging their global allocation. And that's really, you know, a quite significant and substantial decision if you think about the risks of, say, the US dollar selling off when risky assets sell off at the same time. And so, you know, the big lesson for me coming out of the GFC with some of this stuff was really question, you know, those longly held beliefs or firmly held beliefs that exist across the wider market, because they're the source of the greatest instability within markets.
Well, speaking about risky assets, what are you looking at when you're looking at the value of assets? Like, I know that some investors will just say, this is something we're not going to touch ever. There are going to be other things that people will hold on to regardless of what's going on. Are there some that can weather the storm better than others?
Yeah, well, this kind of comes to another, I guess, key learning for us over the last 20 years. And it's funny, I came out of my career at university with this very firm belief in efficient markets and the value of fundamental analysis and how you have to be able to read a balance sheet, that's important for everyone's career. And I'm not saying that that doesn't matter, but you shouldn't discount the technicals. And the technicals is really about price. So price is the intersection of supply and demand. That's, you know, and when we think about the valuations of assets, you know, I like what you said, you know, is there no price at which you'd buy an asset? And, you know, coming out of the GFC, I had a boss who used to say to me, there's no bad assets, just bad prices. And that's an idea that, you know, I certainly don't think you need to take it to extreme and buy anything at a price. But I think too often in markets, we decide we're not buying something at any price. And I think what's important today is really assessing where valuations are and looking at the relativities and saying, okay, what's cheap and what's expensive? And often what we find is that assets become cheap because people fundamentally say, I will not buy that asset at any price. And I think one thing that's really interesting in the market right now is parts of the private lending market, I think, can look quite cheap on a relative sense. And I think the really good thing about credit is, unlike value equities, where something can be cheap for a very long period of time, in credit, you lend someone money and ultimately there's a date at which you get paid back. And so that discount or that cheapness, it gets eroded through time, or, you know, whether you call it the illiquidity premium or that excess return that you get for investing in private assets. Within lending, there's an exit point. Within equities, there isn't. Sometimes you just have to hold the asset and hope that the market's perception of that cheapness, or, you know, they decide that something that they weren't going to touch, all of a sudden they are going to touch today. So I think, you know, that's something we spend a lot of time thinking about. One is this idea of price mattering, you know, the valuation of something really, really matters. But two, also, how are we going to realize that price discount? How are we going to realize that valuation difference?
And you kind of brought up, well, illiquidity there, but I did want to talk about liquidity in general, because I know a lot, especially in times of volatility, a lot of investors, fund managers, they tend to like to hold more liquid assets, simply, I guess, so that they have a little more ample room to move or to switch things up should they need to. But is that the best approach when markets are volatile?
What we find, I think, is everyone's got a different mandate and everyone's definition of liquid and illiquid is different. And really, for me, becoming a better investor was really about understanding the different mandates that are out there in the marketplace. And designing the right mandates can lead to you making much, much better decisions. And Howard Marks of Oaktree's spoken a lot about how having closed-ended funds enabled him to make much, much better decisions about buying and selling assets than, you know, the construct of an open-ended fund. And so I think sometimes that concept of liquidity is viewed through a really narrow lens. And certainly during periods of volatility, what we tend to find is those at the most risk of redemptions, they tend to take the most counter-cyclical, pro-cyclical decisions, I should say. So what they're doing is they're selling when they should be buying. So selling when prices have declined, because they're fearful of redemptions, and then buying when prices are increasing because they're not fearful of redemptions because prices are going up. And what tends to happen is that exacerbates down cycles, because if you're selling something at the lows, you're realizing you're incurring a transaction cost that's larger than you otherwise would incur. Your investors see that and they seek even more redemptions. And so the outcome of that, I think, is that if you're smart about the way that you design mandates, where you have the flexibility to do so, that can drive you to make better investment decisions and more contrarian decisions, where you actually have the ability to be a buyer when markets are selling off, and buy those cheaper assets. And that can change the lens through which you view kind of whether something's liquid or illiquid and the risks around that.
And what about setting up your portfolios to make sure that you're staying defensive while also still being able to jump at new opportunities, especially if the price is right? How do you strike the right balance between that?
That's a constant balance that we're seeking to find in the construction of our portfolios. So balancing our risk appetite and the risk appetite of our investors with with, you know, the pricing where markets are. And it's kind of the question of when markets sell off, do you, you know, add risk in your portfolio and add incremental return, or do you say, I'm going to continue to invest at the target return for my funds and not try to outperform during those down environments? What we tend to find in the way we position things is, number one is we want to be really transparent with our investors about what we're doing with their money, so they understand. You know, my approach has historically been to try to use those periods of volatility to generate some incremental return, but not do it in a really ambitious way. So, you know, when prices are cheaper, that's an opportunity to build more defensiveness in your portfolio without giving up returns. And so you can actually target a lower risk profile, but still generate incremental performance. That tends to be our approach. The other thing we tend to do, because we invest in public and private markets, and there's these really interesting dynamics between how public and private credit trades during periods of volatility. So what we can do is we can move between private into public when public markets are volatile, but move into more defensive assets and then realize those assets at a gain when markets normalize and go back into public, back into private markets without giving up too much in return. And really that's about the fact that private assets and public assets tend to kind of dance to their own tunes a little bit. So they're often not synchronized as to, you know, when they sell off and when they rally. Private credit tends to operate with a bit of a lag. So that creates really interesting opportunities to kind of add defensiveness to your portfolio and add liquidity to your portfolio during periods of volatility.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Eliza.
Thanks for listening to this Financial Standard podcast. For more information, visit financialstandard.com.au. Please keep in mind that the information discussed in this podcast is general in nature and does not consider personal circumstances. Reliance should not be placed on any content without further independent financial research and advice.